A very good afternoon to every one of you. Venerable sir, we are indeed happy and privileged to be with you. You had a very interesting session this morning, and I'm sure we will have an even more interesting session. I will not try to introduce Bante to you. You probably have already done your searches. And he was telling very interestingly this morning how he found his way here. As a young student, went to Japan on an exchange program. He didn't know why he went to Japan. And then he got interested in meditation and Buddhism, obviously. And then when he came back also, he got a book which also talks about meditation, which he started practicing. And then later he found his way to Amaravati Chithas in England. And then he heard about Ajahn Brahm, and now he is living in Australia. I think the important thing for this session today is, as the audience here, Bante is probably the cream of Colombo, the top professionals and top business people. And we are very concerned about all stakeholders of our businesses, and sometimes the most important stakeholder, that is you, is forgotten. And this afternoon is for you. And the Buddha's message, which was delivered 2,500 years ago, is relevant for today to people like us who are in trade and commerce more than the time that he delivered. And we invite you to lead us on that path, how we can integrate these beautiful teachings of Buddha into the world of business and the busy lives of today, which are stretched all over the place. Over to you, Bante.
Okay, thank you.
We will have a little session with you, and then we will open the floor for questions and answers. And the whole idea of this very small crowd is to get the maximum opportunity for each one of you to ask questions and have a good dialogue. A good Dhamma discussion should follow. Metta to every one of you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Very good. So I thought we could maybe start off with a little bit of meditation. I just discussed it with the MC. And maybe just do a little bit of meditation first of all. It's always nice before you have a Dhamma discussion or before you talk about Dhamma to do a bit of peace and calming down, and then often it is easier afterwards to focus more effectively on what is being said and how we have the discussion. Let's just do a bit of meditation together. This will also give you some background understanding on the process of meditation, which is very simple, but still often misunderstood. Okay, so just sit comfortably. It doesn't matter how you sit in meditation. You don't have to sit on the floor, you can sit on a chair, and for most people it's more comfortable to sit on a chair. And close your eyes, and just put your body in a nice and comfortable posture, so you don't have any pains, you don't have any discomforts, and just sit down, and just start off by feeling your body. Feel the body first of all. And the purpose of feeling your body is to make sure that you are 100% relaxed. Sometimes you will feel that there are tensions in the body, tensions in the stomach, tension anywhere really. And the first thing is always to release all that tension and to feel 100% relaxed and at ease. So if you feel that there is tension anywhere, like in the stomach for example, take a few deep breaths, and as the breath goes out, just allow everything to release and relax. And just continue by feeling the body. Don't have to look in any particular place. Just feel the body as a whole. And feel if there is anywhere which is not 100% relaxed. If you find that, place your attention on that place. Have a sense of kindness, of compassion towards yourself, and allow that place to relax and fall to ease, and just feel the sense of delight when the body becomes more at ease. Always make sure that you take plenty of time just to relax at the beginning of the meditation. There is no urgency with going to the breath. Far too many people go to the breath too early. And if you go too early to the breath, all you do is create more tension and more lack of ease. So please don't do that. Relax first of all. By relaxing the body, you're actually relaxing the mind, because it is the mind that controls the body and makes the body not be at ease. Remember, as you allow this process to proceed, remember the attitude is so important. What you need is an attitude of kindness and compassion, especially towards yourself and towards your body. Just know, just thank yourself, thank your body for being of service for all these years. And now you are looking after yourself. Thank you, body. Now it is my turn to look after you. May you be relaxed. May you be at ease. And you will notice if the process is going in the right direction. You will notice that the body starts to feel incredibly comfortable, very relaxed. It becomes almost feather light, as if there's no weight, there's no burden in the body anymore. And what a wonderful feeling that is. This should always be one of the first benefits of meditation practice, that the body kind of fades into the background. And that already is the start of the real deeper sense of meditation. So enjoy that. Enjoy that sense of the body falling away as a burden. And as the body settles down in this way and sort of fades into the background, the mind also tends to become more peaceful. And because the present moment is more relaxed and more at ease than what you normally feel, it means that mindfulness itself becomes strengthened. And with mindfulness comes clarity. And with clarity comes a sense of being at ease, not just in the body, but also in the mind. And now we're coming to the end of this short meditation. Just briefly before we come to the end, just ask yourself how you feel. And ask yourself if you feel better and more relaxed. Ask yourself why that is. What has changed? What have you let go of? What are perceptions that you have developed over the last 15 minutes or so? And once you start to understand these things, then you start to understand how the process of meditation works. And then you can take it into your own hands and apply it in your own life. Okay, so that's the end of the meditation, so please come out. Okay. Very good. Nice to see you all here this afternoon. The things that I'm going to talk about today, they are useful for in a number of different ways. It was suggested to me just before I come in here that everybody in their life, they have like two sides. They want a professional life to work. They want to be able to deal with their professional life in a good way. And there's also the private aspect of life, right? You want to be able to deal with the private, with yourself, to feel good about yourself as well. So these two aspects of life, actually, often it seems like they are two different aspects. But the reality is that these are just two sides of the same coin. If you deal with your personal life in the right way, it enhances your professional life. And if you deal with your professional life in the same way, it enhances your personal life. They're not really different. It's all about how to deal with life in a very general sense. And this is really what this is about. Very simple things. But don't underestimate the simple things in life. You may think that what I'm talking is saying the obvious. And in a way, I am saying the obvious. But the obvious often needs to sink in to in a deep way. And when the obvious becomes profound and deep inside of each one of us, then it starts to have meaning. And I was reminded of this quite recently. One of my very close university friends, he had some fairly tragic things happening to him. About 6 months ago, his son committed suicide. And of course, after the son committed suicide, I got to hear about this. And when I got to hear about this, I wrote him an email to explain, you know, basically what, from a Buddhist point of view, what this means. And then he thanked me afterwards, said, "Wow, thank you for your wisdom." And then a few weeks ago, about 6 months after his son committed suicide, just to make things really bad, his wife committed suicide, right? So he has had his son and wife committing suicide within 6 months. And for most people, that's, that is really tough. It is really a lot of things happening in one go. So again, I tried to help him out. I sent him another email telling him about the nature of life and death and all these things. And again, I said some very basic Buddhist things. And again, I was astonished by the response. The response was, "Thank you for your profound wisdom. It's amazing how these things, you know, amazing how you can say this, you know, that these simple little things have such impact." Now his wife, what is interesting about this story is that his wife, she was the CEO of one of the largest banks in Norway, right? She was the very top of the business hierarchy in the whole Norwegian society. And yet, after her son died, she wasn't able to deal with that in a way that she was able to live with it. She felt so distressed by this whole thing that she also ended up committing suicide. And then I realized, just because somebody is very skilled, just because somebody is a highly acclaimed professional within society, just because somebody is a very good person, she was a very good and very kind-hearted person as well, just because you have those qualities, it doesn't mean that you're able to deal with the difficulties and the hard things in life. And this is what I saw in her. And all I had to do was to say some very simple, to me, very obvious things, and that was enough to kind of help them to understand the situation better. What did I say? I said things like, "This too will pass," right? I'm sure you've heard this saying before. It's one of Adam Brahm's favorite sayings, "This too will pass." But actually, it is incredibly profound. You take it in at a superficial level, and you think, yeah, this too will pass, I understand. But you don't really understand. That's the whole point. It is a very profound and deep teaching. And when you understand this in a deep sense, well, first of all, it helps you to deal with things like when somebody commits suicide, because you know that whatever feeling you harbor after a family member commits suicide, that too will pass. But on an even more profound level, it reminds you that life itself is very uncertain, right? Life comes and it goes. So "this too will pass" reminds you not to expect that things will go the way they do right now forever and ever after. So that's what I said to him. Then I told him, you know, it doesn't matter so much how we die. Life and death comes. It's not how we die. Often there is a lot of stigma associated with suicide. But it's not how we die. It is rather how we live that really matters in the world, right? If we live in a good way and do the right thing, then if we commit suicide or we die in a car accident or in cancer or of old age, that's not really the issue. Have we lived well? And I said, you should rejoice. You had a wonderful wife. She did incredibly well in the world. She was well liked by almost everybody. She had a sense of integrity or morality despite her high achievements. You should be proud. You shouldn't worry about the fact that she has passed away by committing suicide. Right? Wow. Thank you for your profound wisdom. And these things are in many ways so very obvious, but people don't understand very often the obvious things in life. So let me, for that reason, say a few more obvious things to you. I hope you don't mind. And I'll say a few more obvious things, and then afterwards, if you want to ask about other things, please do so. So one of the things about, I think, any life, whether it's business life or ordinary life or whatever it is, is to get life into perspective, to understand life in the bigger picture. Not just, I understand that as a business people, you get very easily drawn into the business. Business becomes everything, and that becomes your life. Why? Well, because it is a very big part of your life. It demands a lot of attention. It demands a lot of energy, etc., etc. So it draws you in. But be careful, if it draws you in too far and you lose perspective, that is when you can make mistakes. So one of the most important things, and I think this was missing in this friend of mine's life, was the ability to get perspective, to draw back a little bit, stand back and look at life in the big context, in the big picture. And when you see the big picture, and you remind yourself of the big picture, perhaps every single day of your life, then it becomes much easier to do what is right, both in business life and also in your private life. So what do I mean by the big picture? And what I mean by the big picture is that life is a very limited thing. It's very fleeting. We come into this world, we don't know when our time is up, right? So what I mean by perspective is the contemplation of death. Remember, you're going to die, right? I try to tell myself this as much as I can. I too am going to die. It's a very, very powerful contemplation. Suddenly, if you remember that you're going to die, then everything you do, every decision you make is made in that context. You know you're going to die. If you're going to die, let's say that you know that in a week's time you're going to die. Let's say that, or even more closely, like say, you know, tomorrow you're going to die. What does that mean for your behavior? How are you going to behave as a consequence? And when I look into myself and I ask myself, what will I do if I know I'm going to die? The Buddha said, ideally, on your next breath, right? That's very hard to imagine. But say tomorrow or in a week's time or whatever you're able to do, what does that do to you? Are you going to start an argument with other people as easily? Are you going to desire the things of this world? What's going to happen in your mind if you remember that you're going to die? And what happens, and this is something you can try for yourself, what happens is that you tend to become more peaceful, right? You tend to become less interested in the things of this world. And when you become less interested in things of this world, you have less attachment, you have less desire, you have less anger and irritation of the things going around you, you get more clarity here, right? You get clarity because you understand what is really important in life, what really matters. You can stand back and you can say, wow, now I understand what is important in life. And then you can make decisions which are much clearer, both for yourself privately, but even as it happens, also for your business or whatever it is that you are doing here. So this idea of death, of just reminding yourself that you're going to die, is actually something extraordinarily powerful. I met a man a few years ago. He was also of Sri Lankan origin. He lives in Australia now, but he was of Sri Lankan origin. And he told me that every day when he was a psychologist, and he told me every day when he leaves his house, he reminds himself, today I could die. And because he reminded himself of that, every day he left his family in a good way, right? He said goodbye to his children, his wife, in a good way, because he knew I may not see them again later on. So this is a very powerful way, a very simple but useful way of using that death contemplation. The same thing if you are a manager in a company. You know, you may never see your employees again. This may be the last time you see them. You could die on the way back from work today. What does that mean? It means that you have a bit more time, a bit more balance in your mind when you deal with the people around you. Whether it's family, whether it's employees, whether it's just an ordinary person in the street, whoever it is, it puts things into perspective and you remind yourself of this. So death contemplation can be very, very powerful. I'm going to put this in even more perspective for you, just to allow me to elaborate a little bit, because this I found very useful in my own life. And my feeling is always, if it's useful for me, it's probably useful for other people as well. And this is the Buddha. The Buddha reminds us that, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, there isn't just this life, but life then continues on into the future. So this life is like this tiny sliver, right? This tiny sliver right here goes on into the past. You don't know how far into the past. And then it goes on into the future. You have no idea how far into the future. But if this is true, that all we have here is this tiny little sliver, that's all we see and that's all we know about, but that actually the reality is much vaster than that, then how are you going to invest your time? Are you going to invest your time that only deals with this particular sliver of time right now? Or are you going to invest your time in such a way that it actually affects the whole big picture of lives also into the future? Now, this is a Buddhist point of view, so it only really, if you don't believe in rebirth, well, then it becomes a bit more difficult. But if you have an idea of the idea of rebirth, it becomes incredibly meaningful. People sometimes ask me, why do we believe in rebirth anyway? What difference does it make? And the reality, it makes enormous difference. If you only focus on this life, you tend to just invest in this life, right? This is where you invest all your energy and all your efforts in your status, in your belongings, in your relationships. Everything becomes focused on this life. If you remember the bigger thing here, then you focus on the investment into this bigger period. What is that investment? Is investment in the mind. Investment in how we deal with the world, how we act in the world, whether we act with anger or with metta, with loving kindness, whether we act with understanding or compassion, or we act with cruelty and ruthlessness, all of these things come from that bigger picture view. If you have the bigger picture view, it changes how you invest your time. And it's just as if a very easy way to understand this is to understand if you are renting a house, right? You rent a house, it's only, say, for a short period of time, for 6 months, right? How much time, how much money, how much of yourself are you going to invest in a house that you are renting from somebody else and you have to give back in 6 months? Not that much, right? Maybe a little bit to make it look nice. You're not going to refurbish the whole house at your expense if you're renting it from somebody else, right? And this is the point. This life is limited. Everything in this life is borrowed. We're borrowing all this stuff, right? Even our body is borrowed. We have it for a while, we've got to give it up. Everything else too is borrowed. And because it's borrowed, please don't invest too much in borrowed goods. Invest in the stuff which actually has a lasting impact into the future. So this is number one. This is just a little bit about death contemplation. The Buddha was he said death contemplation is incredibly important for everybody. He said literally everybody. And because of that, I think it can be a very useful tool to remind us what actually matters in life. And if you do that death contemplation in the right way, and it leads to a sense of clarity in your mind, a sense of clarity about what is right and what is wrong, about how to make decisions in life, then it is going in the right way here. But the second thing I want to talk about is actually how to make decisions. Okay, you get a bit of clarity from doing things like death contemplation, but more generally speaking, how do we make decisions in life? And if you are in a position of responsibility, making decisions is one of those very important things, right? So I'm going to tell you a few ways how to make decisions. And the first way, this is Ajahn Brahm's way, right? Ajahn Brahm is my teacher in Australia, and he's a bit cheeky. That's why I was smiling just now. I was thinking about what I was going to say, and I thought. And Ajahn Brahm says, well, if you're going to make a decision, you take a coin, right? coin has heads and tails, right? And you say decision A or decision B, right? This way or that way. You flip the coin, land in your palm. If it's tails, it's A. If it's heads, it's B. You look, tails. Oh no, I didn't, oh no, I didn't really want to do that, right? This is how you make a decision. You don't actually make the decision by flipping the coin. You make the decision based on the reaction that you have when you see the result. So if you see tails, didn't really like that, okay, then you do heads instead. So this is one cheeky way of making a decision. But I want to take it a bit further than that, because sometimes that doesn't work. And one of the most important ways of making decision, and it was interesting, I was reading a newspaper article on management, I can't remember, but somebody had done some research on how CEOs, or not the CEOs, anybody in the position of management, I think, how they make decisions, and who are the people who are most successful in making the right decisions in life. That was one of the factors that was made, that was kind of considered. And they found that the people who make the best decisions, they are the ones that go with the gut feeling, right? They are the ones that make the best decisions. It sounds counterintuitive. You think, well, the people that analyze the most, right, get all the analysis right, and they are the ones that make the best decisions. No, the very best managers of the very kind of biggest companies or whatever it was, or the best people, they follow their gut decision, their intuition, right? And then they use the analysis to back up the gut the gut instinct, right? So that's what analysis is about. It's about backing up the gut instinct. And this is, life is often like that, isn't it? We are creatures who feel. We feel things. And because we feel things, feeling is an incredibly important part of life. And we are driven by feelings. Because we are driven by feelings, gut instinct and emotions are often more important than rational analysis. Of course, I'm not saying that there is no scope for rational analysis. Of course there is. But very often, it is the gut feeling that is most important. So how can we trust our gut feeling? How do we know that the gut feeling is right? And this becomes a very important issue. If you're going to go with your gut feelings, and you trust those gut feelings in yourself, maybe because you have a past history of success or whatever, the way to trust your gut feeling is to know the state of your mind while that gut feeling is there. If your state of mind is not quite right, if there is a sense of desire there, a sense of aversion, a sense of confusion, a sense of you don't really know what's going on, then your gut instinct is likely to be, or quite possibly, going to be wrong. If your mind is clear, right, you have just been having a nice meditation or whatever, and mind has a sense of clarity inside of it, you feel that you're not driven by any kind of desire, any kind of negativity or any kind of confusion, then that is when your gut instinct is reliable. This is something the Buddha says in the suttas. When you are free of defilements in the mind, that is when you can remember the events and things that happened a long time ago. That is when your mind has clarity about these things, and it's easy to do what is right. So this is one of the most important things. If you're going to make a decision, always make a decision when you have clarity of mind. If you haven't got clarity of mind, procrastinate. Just wait. One of the kind of basic kind of management techniques is procrastination, apparently. You procrastinate as much as you possibly can. Because I've studied business myself, actually. There was a professor at UCLA, University of California in Los Angeles, who said that procrastination is one of the most undervalued management techniques. You just wait as long as you possibly can before you make a decision. And certainly don't make a decision until you have a sense of clarity about it. So this is number one, wait for clarity. Number two, how to make decisions. Remember what is important in life, what really matters. So what is important according to the Buddha's teaching here? And what is important according to the Buddha's teaching is that we are improving in good qualities and going down in bad qualities, right? And you can apply this to yourself. You can apply it to the... excuse me. You can apply it to the people around you, huh? What is it that in the long run is going to lead to an improvement in the good qualities? But apply it especially to yourself, because remind yourself what is really important in life. What is important in life is how I was talking about before, right? When you die and you look back upon your life, what is it that you're going to remember? What you're going to remember is how you acted, what kind of person you were, whether you had a sense of kindness in the world, whether you had a sense of understanding of the people around you, whether you were a peaceful and good-hearted person. This is what you're going to die on your death. This is what you're going to remember on your deathbed. This is what matters. So if you think about this now when you make a decision, make a decision so that you know that this decision in the long run is going to lead to more positive states inside of you and less negative states. And then you're building up a sense of a personality and a person and habits in your life that actually lead to something that you will feel very good about when eventually you have to pass away from this life. It's a very powerful technique. I use this all the time when I decide what I'm going to do. You know, should I travel through Sri Lanka or not? It's not obvious whether I should do that. But then I consult with other people or whatever, and I ask, should I undertake this? And then I look inside myself, will it lead to an improvement in my good qualities and a reduction in the bad ones? And the answer is, well, if I do it in the right way, if I do it with a sense of kindness and compassion, with the idea of doing service to other people, yes, it will lead to good states and a decline in the bad ones. So you do that. When I decide whether I'm going to stay in this monastery or that monastery, when I decide whether I'm going to be a Buddhist or not, right? Am I going to be a Buddhist? Am I going to be something else? The decision is based on the idea it's going to be for an improvement in my good qualities and a decline in the bad ones. And everything in life can be based on that very simple decision. So that's how I make decisions in my life. So keep these things in mind, right? Tossing the coin, number one, can be very, very handy if you're in a hurry or whatever. Number two, remember the clarity of the mind. And remember that what really matters in life, the improvement of your personal qualities. So that is how we can actually deal with these things. But to actually achieve that clarity of mind, to be able to have enough clarity, to be able to see what is right, and to trust your gut feeling, there are a few other things that you can do to help you with that. And one of those things is to remember, you can always use a little bit of meditation in life. It doesn't mean that you have to kind of sit down for hours every day. I'm absolutely sure that many of you are very, very busy as you are. You don't actually have time for that. But even if you just sit a little bit, and I'm sure you noticed that before, just by sitting back for 10 minutes, even if your mind is rushing around, right? Even if you're thinking about all kinds of stuff, still you feel more peaceful afterwards than you felt when you started out. So just a little bit of meditation, just to allow yourself to kind of put the brakes on a little bit, not allow the mind to kind of spin out of control quite so much, can often be enough to give you that little bit of extra clarity to make sure that you actually make better decisions in ordinary life. And I've heard some beautiful stories. I mean, often you have to decide yourself what is the best way for doing this. I don't really, as a monk, you know, my schedule is obviously very different from yours. But I've heard many stories of how people do this. And one of the techniques is every hour, you sit down and you close your eyes for 1 or 2 minutes. And all you do is just allow everything just to kind of become more peaceful within 1 or 2 minutes every hour, right? Just to calm yourself a little bit down so you get a little bit more clarity, especially if you feel that things are kind of, you're getting a little bit stressed or you're getting a bit restless or whatever, then it's always a very good time to do that. That is one way of calming things down. Another way, this is a more radical solution, right? This was apparently a lawyer in London. Azam Brahm told me this story. Maybe you heard this one before. He said there was a lawyer in London, and he had this one cupboard in the room, in his lawyer's room, right? His cupboard against the wall, and nobody really knew what it was for, right? It was just kind of sitting there. He never really seemed to go in there, but this cupboard was a cupboard where he would meditate. So every day, what he would do in the middle of the day sometime, he had a certain period, half an hour or whatever it was, I think it was about half an hour, and he would get into this cupboard, right, probably in a suit and everything, get into this cupboard. In London, people are really kind of properly dressed, you know, and they had bowler hats and all those kind of things. And he would actually get into this cabinet, and he would sit down, and he would get his secretary to lock the door, right? Okay, let me out in half an hour. And he would sit in this cabinet, which is dark, it was quiet, and he would sit there for half an hour doing his daily meditation practice. And the idea, again, is just to recharge your batteries. And when you come out of a half an hour's meditation, you feel recharged in another way. So this is what meditation is should really be about. It has at least two, many very great qualities. It makes your decision-making more powerful because you have more clarity of mind. But also, it is a personal thing. You just feel better about yourself when you have more clarity. You feel better about yourself when you feel more relaxed, right? It actually also has this dual thing here. And this is everything you do in life. If it is according to Buddhist principles, it always has both aspects to it. It's better for yourself and it is better for the other people in your life, whether it's people in your company, people in your family, or whatever it is. And you don't have to do very much. A little bit is enough. And then what you can do is you can also expand that to anybody, if you are in a position of management, to expand that to the employees in the company. This is becoming very common now, especially in the West. And they say, you know, people often hire people, they don't hire monks so much, but they hire other people who teach the staff about mindfulness meditation. And it sounds perhaps very cynical, and the reason they do that is because then it increases productivity, right? So people get very cynical about that. What? You just want me to meditate so I can increase productivity? Oh, I don't, you know. So you have to be careful how you sell this thing here. And of course, the point is, it doesn't just increase productivity. It also increases the personal and subjective well-being of every employee. So it's a win-win situation. You have to be very careful how we phrase these things. Otherwise, people become cynical about what we're doing here. So if you have that in your company, maybe you have a place, a room where people can meditate. Maybe you can invite a meditation teacher to teach those who are interested in these things. You're actually often enhancing the well-being of the people and also the productivity of the company. I think I can't remember now the exact results, but if you have 15 or 20, I can't remember the exact numbers, 15 or 20 minutes of meditation increases the productivity overall in the company, even though you take that time out to actually do these things. So very, very useful and simple technique on how to enhance one's own life and also the life of the company as such. Okay, so maybe I will stop there. Yeah, I think I will stop there. We can maybe go on to some more Q&A and discussion and things. I'm not sure exactly what your, you know, what kind of things that you are interested in talking about. Since they don't meet us talking on, I think this might be a good time to stop. So let's move on to next stage. Yeah. Difficult one. Okay. Yeah. You're welcome to ask anything you like. There's no barriers, no limits here, right? Anything is okay. Yes, please. Yeah. Yeah. How do you deal with people who you find difficult and make you anger and irritate and all those kind of things? I think that's a very important point, and it's something that affects us everywhere, you know, everywhere, every aspect of life. And of course, it also affects you as a monk as well. This is part of life, really. And there's many, many replies to that. But the reply I gave this morning in this morning's talk is that the best way is to understand that people just are the way they are, not because they want to be difficult, right? You may find somebody very hard to deal with in life and very upsetting in many ways, but remember that they are the way they are because they have been conditioned to be the way they are. Often people want to be a different way if they know that they are irritating others. Actually, nobody wants to irritate other people. It's a hassle. If you are an irritation to the people around you, you become incredibly unpopular. You become a pain in the neck for everyone, right? Nobody wants to be like that. So remember that. The reason why people are the way they are is because they have been conditioned into being that way. It's all about cause and conditions in the past, creating the personality that you have now. And even if they want to be kind, they can't help themselves but to do the wrong things. Even if, and I'm sure all companies have the kind of troublemakers, right, in the company who kind of make things difficult. This is what I've heard anyway. There's always somebody who's difficult. Remember, they are the way they are because they have been conditioned into being what they are. Often people want to be different. If you're not able to do the right thing, if you're not capable of doing what is nice and what is kind to others because of your conditioning, and the bad things come out, even though you want to be good, then how can you feel about such a person? You have to have compassion for them, right? They're not able to actually live up to their own standards because the conditioning in them is so strong. So this is how to deal with people, and this is how to think about them. Remind yourself that this person is the way they are, not because they want to annoy you or want to annoy anybody else. It is just the nature has actually arrived in this way over a long period of time. And of course, I recognize that in business life, it is often difficult. You know, how do you, I mean, if you have a staff and you want people to be able to work together, you have all these responsibilities to make things work. But I remember I was reading somebody, this was somebody else who was talking about business. This was an Australian person, I think, who had been the CEO of a large company for a long time, and he talked about his experiences and what he had learned after being a CEO for such a long time. And apparently there is a fairly well-known thing that in any business, 20% of the people do 80% of the work, and the 80% do 20% of the work. There are certain kind of crucial employees that kind of do most of the kind of heavy lifting. And he said that after a while he realized that people are different, right? That it's not about bringing up everybody up to the levels, everybody is the same, everybody is equally efficient. It can't happen because we are conditioned the way we are, because we are so different as people. Instead of actually trying to lift everybody up to be as efficient as the 20%, we have to accept those 80% the way they are, because that is basically how they are, right? And this is this insight again, this insight into non-self, anatta, right? This idea that we are conditioned into who we are and that nature cannot really be changed. And to understand how difficult it is to change, I always like to bring it back to myself. And I look at my own life, and when I want to change, right, I want to change my old habits, whatever they might be, and I recognize how difficult it is to change myself, right? Think about yourself. Think about you. Especially perhaps very often, the good place to start is in relationship to your family. Because in family connections, we are so close to each other that very often we bring up reactions towards each other, very habitual reactions. Now, if you want to change the way you react to your family members, it is incredibly hard. It's very, very difficult. The same kind of thing tends to trigger the same emotions month after month, year after year. Why is it so hard? Because the habits are so ingrained, because it's non-self, because you have been conditioned in this way over a long, long period of time. It's so difficult to change yourself. How can you ask other people to change if it is so difficult to change yourself and change your own habits and your own conditioning? So this is really what it's about. It's about understanding the nature of what it means to be human. And once you understand the nature of what it is to be human, then you can start to forgive and let go and not get so angry with them. It's not personal, right? It's not about you. It's not a personal thing. It's about them. They are in a position of difficulty. So this is like a big picture thing. It's like a kind of a, you know, it's a Buddhist way of looking at problematic things in life. What I also remember, I had one of my other university friends. He came to visit me in Perth quite recently at our monastery in Perth. He's also a CEO. I have a lot of very successful friends for some reason. He's CEO of a big software company in the US. And he said that one of the ways of dealing with difficult people is that you know, people are always complaining about things, right? This is part of life, whether you're in business or wherever you are. One of the ways that he had been taught to deal with difficulties and deal with difficult people is to get everybody to write down the difficulties, right? So everybody writes down a difficulty. This is all anonymous, and nobody knows who is saying what. Otherwise, nobody's going to say anything if it's not anonymous. So everybody writes down the difficulties. And then you make a long list of all the difficulties that all the employees in the company have mentioned. You make a long list, and then you pass it around the office staff, right? And everybody makes a tick to the particular difficulty that they agree with, right? Everybody makes a tick. And then there are certain things on that long list that get lots of ticks. And then there are other things that only get one or two ticks. And what he said that was interesting about this list is that many of those things that got lots of ticks on them, they were very simple things to do. People were saying, oh, there's not enough coffee in the office, right? Whatever it is, very, very simple things that can be fixed up. So he said that the great thing about that, you can make a lot of people a lot happier because you understand the big grievances that are actually happening in the office. And this is a beautiful way of kind of giving a bit of support to the employees, right? They understand that you care. And this idea of caring is so important in the family, in the corporate world, whatever it is. If your employees feel that you're caring, that you are caring for them, they're going to listen to you. They're going to be much more effective in their job. If they feel that you don't care, they're not going to care back, basically. So you fix up all those things that have many things. And often, he said, they are so simple to fix up. You don't have to do very much. But the other interesting thing about this list is that every company has, I'm sure, habitual complainers. People are always griping about things, saying this is no good, right? This is just, life is like that. Always people who are negative about things. They see for the first time, people tend to think, oh, this is my problem. Everybody has the same problem. But they see that thing that they were complaining about, right, only gets one tick. And that's their tick. Nobody else is complaining about that. So it causes those people who have all these gripes all the time to self-reflect and to understand that maybe I shouldn't be going around complaining so much as I did before. They see themselves in a different perspective, right? So he said he was very happy with that technique. He said it solved many problems in the office at the same time. This is just one example. And there's many, many things you can do. This is one example of how you can kind of deal with difficult issues. So are you happy with that answer? Or does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah, I am. But at the same time, sometimes it's the attitude of the person. Sometimes if it is one-off incident, you can just ignore.
Yeah.
But if the attitude is... it remains, then it becomes a thorn in your flesh.
Yeah.
You just want to get it out.
Yeah.
Pull the thorn out.
Yeah.
That's the attitude that I have.
Yeah.
If I have something like that. So that's the problem that I have when I'm confronted with something like that.
Mm.
How do I deal with that? The way I do it now is to walk away from it. But that doesn't mean the problem is gone away because I might be suffering.
Yeah.
Just like the lady that who committed suicide.
Yeah.
Not that I'm going to commit suicide over the incident. But the thing is that I might be having that in me, and you know, sort of, I may be stressful for a time until the next problem comes.
Yeah. Sure. Sure. It is. There's no final solution to these things, right? The only final solution is becoming a monk. You know, that's the final solution. Everything else is temporary. No, but you're right. But, you know, the thing to do is remember that this is their habit. This is the way they are. They're not going to change, right? Remember that. Don't think they're going to change. One of the reasons you get upset is because you want the person to be different. The person won't be different. This is the thing you have. This is kind of what you have to understand. This is the person. This is how they are. They're always going to be difficult. And once you understand that this is their personality, this is how they are. They can't change. Even if they want to change, they can't. Then you can start to accept. The problem starts to be reduced. It's your desire for change that is the biggest problem here. it's difficult to do, right? But actually, if you do this again and again and again, it actually makes a difference. So anyway, that's okay. Anybody else wants to say anything here? Yes.
Some sounded new, some, of course, things we've known in the past, the fact, you know, we don't sort of use some of these principles that you educated. You talked about death contemplation, you know, as a principle to try and, you know, find happiness that we need to, you know, have in life. But as far as businesses are concerned, given that opportunities are limited for every single business organization, regardless of which industry or which segment of the business you're in, you got to have very high level of optimism in the minds of your employees to be able to drive them towards achieving results. And in business, you need to succeed to be able to, you know, achieve those commercial objectives. And in business, performance is all about achieving results. And then results, you know, in terms of goals that we set at the beginning of the year, are extremely optimistic. Year-on-year basis, you know, you want better results achieved. And markets cannot really support you for you to be able to achieve those goals.
Yeah.
So you've got to basically eat into your competitor's plate if you are to achieve that level of results.
Sure.
So that creates competition, and without competition, there is no success. So that's your professional life. So how do we, you know, balance the two?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm struggling to understand. Thanks.
Sure. Yeah, this is always a problem. This is competition must, in the end, must always cause conflict, must cause problems. That's the nature of competition, right? You compete in school and you compete in life for a partner in life, for a wife or a husband. Competition is always a problem. And this is one of the things the Buddha says. The Buddha says very clearly in the sutta that when you have desire, competition is about desire. I want to win, you want to win. I want this partner, you want this partner. I want this. Whenever you have desire, it always also leads to ill will and negativity and harm. Desire and harm always go together. There's always going to be a nature, a degree of conflict in business. It has to be there. It's part of life. So your job is to minimize it. That's basically your job. Your job is to understand what you're doing to your competitor. Your job is to understand the pain and suffering they may have if they go bankrupt, right? I've had this question asked to me before. You know, what I'm doing, I'm being really ruthless. My competitor's going bankrupt. What should I do? Well, at least if you understand their suffering, then maybe you can hire them, right? Maybe they have some good qualities. So you hire them. Say, okay, come, be part of my team. You can do this part of the job instead, right? Something like that. And you look at things in a new way. Or if they are suffering really badly, maybe you can help out in some other way. But the most important thing, I think, and this is what I have seen with many people who had success in business, and this is if you consistently try to do what is right, at least within your company, with the people that you are with, the people who are closest to you, if you consistently apply Buddhist principles in daily life, you tend to have success. People start to trust you. People start to feel at ease in your company. I know a lady who's one of the top executives of Hewlett Packard in Singapore, and she has kind of risen up through the ranks in Hewlett Packard, and she rigorously applies Buddhist principles in everything she does, right? Towards her customers, towards her employees, towards her superiors, towards the people on equal footing. I don't know what she does with the competitors, but That's what she does, and she rigorously applies that. And because people feel they can trust her, people feel at ease in her company and all these things, she kind of rises to the top. And I have, what I have seen in my life is that those people who win, winning is all relative, but those people who go the highest in the corporate world are not the people who are the most ruthless. The most ruthless are the people who get distrusted. Nobody trusts you after a while. Nobody wants to deal with you because you're too ruthless, right? The people who have the most success are the people who aren't really all that interested in advancement, right? You're not a threat to anybody. You're just kind. You're just a good person. But because people see those good qualities in you, and because nobody is afraid of you, you cannot just kind of drift to the top all by yourself. You're drifting on your abilities and on your morality, on your sila, rather than on the basis of your kind of being ruthless or whatever in competition. So you're right, and I think that is kind of perhaps the price you have to pay in business. Yes, there is going to be that problem out there with competitors. There's always going to be competition. Be kind, be good wherever you can, and sometimes people are going to be hurt. See if there's anything you can do to kind of help alleviate their situation as well, if you get there, whatever that might be. But I think that is probably a price you have to pay. That's how the capitalist economy works, right? This is the whole kind of underpinning of society. That probably is, there's probably some price there that you have to pay in the end. So I don't know if there is any final answer to that one. I think it's just the nature of how our society works. Yeah. Okay. Yes, at the back there.
There are commitments. We have family. There are people who rely on our support. So if we look at our bigger picture, that's almost a selfish way of looking at ourselves, and maybe in a way letting down all those people who are. Because by detaching yourself, you detach from those people who love you. So how do you reconcile that?
Okay. So the thing about any kind of spiritual teaching, any kind of spiritual act, any kind of spiritual way of thinking or way of leading your life, if it is really something which is Buddhist or spiritual or good, it is always good both for yourself and for the other person. If you do something which actually turns out to be selfish, it is probably the wrong thing to do. This is the paradox of this thing. The real selfish act, the real act which leads to a better life for yourself, is not actually selfish. And if anything you do which feels selfish is already not really selfish, because it's not going to lead to your happiness in the long run. So the acts that actually are the right ones are the ones that are good for you and also good for your family. That are good for you and also for your employees. It's good for everybody. If you are generous, it's good for the person you're generous towards. It's also good for yourself because you feel good about it afterwards. If you're kind to somebody, it's good for the person you're kind towards. It's also good for you because you feel good about your kindness. If you do a bit of meditation, it's good for you because you feel more peaceful. And it's good for others because you have more time for them afterwards. So it is not like that. It's not. There is no distinction here. There is no distinction either me or the other. It's always both. If you do the right thing, it's always both. And this thing about detachment, you don't have to worry about detachment so much, because this is a very, very slow process. You can't just choose to be more detached. Detachment or attachment is a state of mind. And as long as you have a sense of self, as long as you have a sense of being somebody in this world, you're going to have attachment. You cannot choose not to have attachment. The way that attachment decreases and detachment becomes more powerful is just through doing the right thing. If you do what is right and you live the good life, then detachment tends to happen by itself gradually as a matter of course. Whether you want to or not, a little bit of detachment happens. When you are more detached, you actually improve your ability to do what is right, both for yourself and for others. If you have a strong attachment to somebody, it means that you have a vested interest, not in the other person, but you have a vested interest in how they behave so that you can feel happy about it, right? If you are attached to your child and your child becomes a drug addict, you will feel ashamed. You don't want to tell your neighbors. You feel bad about it. The reason is because you are attached, not because you love the child, but it's because of your self-interest. You have a vested interest in how the child behaves. right? If you are detached, it means you have less vested interest. When you have less vested interest, your mind is more clear and you can make better decisions about what is in the true best interest of your child or what is not. Right? So sometimes these things are actually very complicated. They're not simple answers there. But detachment is usually a very positive thing. It doesn't mean being cold-hearted. It doesn't mean rejecting other people. It means having less vested interest in how that people is and how they behave. And then you can see what is truly beneficial for them and also what is truly beneficial for you. And the two should always go together. That makes sense. Am I making sense? Yeah? You sure? Yeah? Okay. Good.
We spend a lot of time in meetings, in companies, and yes. A lot of decisions are made in meetings.
Yes.
How do you set a tone so that people have clarity and people are calm when these decisions are made? Because they tend to affect a lot of people. So people may not, you know, have that sense of clarity when they come for meetings. How can one create that atmosphere that people are mindful and clear?
Okay. Yes, that is that's an interesting point. And I suspect that one of the most important things is to have a good feeling in the room, right? A feeling that people feel relaxed and they feel at ease. That is one of the most important things, and I guess this is one of the things that is your responsibility as a leader. If somebody is a leader, it is your responsibility to set the tone in the room, that there's a friendly tone, a feeling that people can relax. If people are relaxed, they make better decisions than if they are tense and feel kind of, things are difficult. And you can also do a couple of minutes of meditation, right? Say, okay, everybody close your eyes, take a few deep breaths, right? Relax, and just let things be. And then feel which decision feels right to you at that particular point. This is one way you can do that. Right? And then you allow people that little bit of extra space in the sense where the right decision can kind of rise up from inside. It is very strange. I mean, one of the things that I have always found in my own life is that you think about a decision, you think and think and think, and you can never really find the answer, what is the right way to go. This is such a common experience, I think, for people. You don't know what the answer is. And suddenly one day, you just sit back and you relax, and the answer just pops into your mind, right? All that analysis, all that thinking about it, was a waste of time. And when you recognize that, when you recognize the kind of lack of ability very often of the thinking mind to resolve things, when you understand that, you actually can allow yourself to be more peaceful, allow yourself to stop all the thinking and just say, okay, when the time is right, then the solution will come by itself. Of course, sometimes there's pressure. You have to solve the things earlier on, and then you have to try to create a similar kind of situation where things are relaxed and at ease, and you just allow the solution to come to itself. So try to create that sense, that kind of environment for the whole group, and then it is likely you're able to create better group decisions as a consequence. Something like that. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. One of the conflicts you always tend to deal with is this conflict of the misunderstanding of what is being content. As a business leader or as an entrepreneur, you're not only responsible for yourself, you're also responsible for the whole group of people within the enterprise,
yeah.
Whose future prosperity,
yeah.
Or future growth you're responsible for. So how do you handle this whole concept of being content?
Right. Okay. So yeah, this is in a sense a kind of a, I guess one of the differences here. As a company, you're supposed to kind of improve, you're supposed to move forward. And if you're too content, you probably get fired, right? Oh, I'm content, okay. You lose your job. But I think, contentment is about, it's a personal thing. It's a thing that you have inside of yourself. And I think one of the most important things with contentment is that you are content with your own life. Your life is good enough. You don't have too much vested interest. If you get fired or not, you know, don't care too much about that. You don't care too much about the worldly things in the world, but you're happy with your life as it is. You don't need, you know, I mean, sometimes you may think, oh, it would be nice to get a higher position, it would be nice to have this, to have that. Contentment just means you're satisfied with what you have already. And I have actually noticed in my life that those people who are most successful often tend to be very contented. They're very happy people, right? They have a natural optimism inside. They're very positive. When you're with them, you feel this kind of natural exuberance. But they also have a sense of peace about them. They are, on a personal level, they are content. But precisely because they are content on a personal level, it means they have more clarity of mind about what is right and what is wrong. So their company prospers, even though they have a personal sense of contentment. So contentment is really, is in many ways similar to the death contemplation. The death contemplation also makes you content. You don't really want, you don't desire anything more. There's nothing more in this world to go for. You don't allow yourself to get upset by the people around you. Contentment is exactly the same thing. These two things gel together, go together like that. And then when you have that personal sense of contentment, clarity arises. You can make better decisions for your company. This is a weird thing, right? This is kind of a strange thing. It sounds like you're not supposed to be content because that drives you, but actually very often you get that actually biases you instead. I don't know, I've heard about some of the people who, you know, are traders on the stock exchange and these kind of things, people who do trading all the time, currency trading or stock trading or whatever it is. And they have personality tests to find out what kind of person is does these things well. And the people who are too anxious and have too many defilements and too much desire to win or lose and who are afraid of these things, they're often the people who don't succeed. The people who are really cool about this, right? They don't really care whether it goes up or down. They are the ones who often kind of succeed in this kind of stock trading things because you have to have a very incredibly cool kind of personality. That's contentment. Contentment is about being cool, right? So you have that coolness with you, you have a personal sense of contentment, and then clarity arises as a consequence. It's strange, it sounds like a paradox, but actually it isn't. It actually is the way I think things work. I always found that the people who are... One example is actually another friend of mine. He is a Buddhist in Norway. And they have recently purchased some land in Norway to start a Buddhist monastery over there. And he is the one who finances this whole Buddhist monastery. It's a kind of 100 acres, right? They want to build a nice monastery, and they have invited me a few times, but I haven't been interested. They're going to maybe find somebody else. But regardless of all that, he is the kind of person who he built up a company from nothing, from zero, to being a very big and successful company. And it was sold off to Reuters a few years ago for a large, large sum of money. And now he has all this money in his bank, and he wants to use it to build monasteries, right? And he's a Norwegian, not even... Well, he's Buddhist now, I suppose, but he wasn't born as a Buddhist. And what a wonderful thing that is. And I remember he was asked in a newspaper interview, because it was obviously, when you have that much success, you tend to get interviewed by the newspapers. And this newspaper, this journalist asked him, well, you must be really pleased, right? You built this company all from scratch, and now you have made all this money. And he said, and his reply was, the money was just a side effect. Right? I wasn't interested in the money. I wasn't doing this for the money. The money was just a side effect. I did this because it was fun, because it was the right thing. I built up a company out of the sheer joy of doing what is right and what is good. The money is a side effect. I never cared about that. So he was the kind of person, and when you meet him, he's the kind of person who is naturally happy, naturally joyous, a contented kind of person, basically. And he is the one who had success. And that's what I often find in my experience in life. So, the paradoxes of existence. Yeah. Okay. Anything else we haven't covered that needs to be talked about? Yes, over there. The law of manifestation.
And that we are not... creatures of circumstance, that we have the power to change our life.
Sure, you have power to change your life. And this is one of the most important things, I think, in Buddhism, is that we have that power. This is actually very foundational, right? And I will I was giving, I don't know if you, were you there at the talk this morning? No, you were not there, okay. I'll give you an example of how this works, because I mentioned this at the talk in the Q&A session this morning. And the way that you can actually feel for yourself how this works is by looking at your actions in daily life and how they affect your mind. And you will actually see that there is a very close relation between how you act and how you feel inside of yourself. You have to have a degree of mindfulness to actually be able to appreciate this. But if you have enough mindfulness, you will see this very strongly. And notice that when you do an act which isn't very kind, right? Sometimes everybody does acts which isn't very kind. It's just nature. And I look inside of myself. If I say something which wasn't quite right, or even if I think a thought which isn't quite right, what does it feel like? And what it feels like your energy level gets depleted. You feel less happy. You feel less bright. You feel as if there is a burden happening inside of your mind, right? And that is how you can understand that you are creating your own future. If you keep on doing what is bad, you're building that burden in your mind. You're building that darkness in your mind, that lack of brightness in your mind. You're expanding that until the day comes that your mind is basically not very good place to be at all anymore. And if your mind isn't a very good place to be, you're not going to be a very happy person. That's basically what we are, is our minds, right? So you can see this. I encourage you, feel that, experience that. And that's how you can understand how you're actually building up your future and also the present. And the opposite is if you do something kind. Watch yourself. You do something really kind towards somebody else, right? You say something nice. Even you think a thought of metta, you know, may you be happy, may you be well. How does that feel? And you feel, if you do it from your heart, it really is heartfelt. You feel a brightness inside of yourself. You feel energized. You feel like you're lifted up. You feel like you're chucking out some of the burdens that are holding you down. And you are soaring, right? That's what it feels like. And you know from that if you keep on doing that, you're going to build a mind which is brighter and brighter and brighter. And you're creating a future for yourself in that sense. So this is how you manifest the future. And the external world would change as well. Why? Because the external world, how we perceive the external world, depends a lot on our mind state. How you look at the world outside is actually depends on how what your mind state is in right now. So it changes things. I will give you an example. I always like to give examples from my, especially from my teacher Ajahn Brahm, because he's kind of a special case in many ways. And he is one of these people who loves concrete, right? He thinks concrete is fantastic. Most people say concrete is terrible, all this grey stuff. He loves concrete. So he says in the monastery, oh, we've got to have concrete here, we've got to have concrete there, all the roads should be concrete, right? Everybody else said, no, please, no more concrete. We had enough of concrete. But he says, no, concrete is good, concrete is great. And I was always puzzled by this Ajahn Brahm's love affair for concrete. Until one day, he tells us the story from when he was a young monk. And when he was a young monk in Thailand under the Ajahn Chah, one of the great meditation teachers in Thailand in the last century, they had this meditation hall. And in the meditation hall, they had a concrete floor. And on this concrete floor, that's where they would do their walking meditation, right? Now, Ajahn Brahm, he's famous for being an incredibly good meditator. So when he would do his walking meditation back and forth on this concrete floor, he would say the concrete floor was like this explosion in colors, right? It was this incredibly beautiful thing. Because when your samadhi gets deep, your perceptions change profoundly. And all he sees is these beautiful colors and these magnificent shapes coming out of the concrete. And after that, he has always loved concrete, right? And this is how things work, and this is essentially true for each one of us. The world outside is dependent on the world inside. Remember, I mean, in ordinary world, we tend to divide between our inner life and our outer life as if they are two separate things. But in the end, life is just about experience, right? You experience stuff, and everything from the outside also is really just felt inside of you. Okay, you see these curtains, you see this roof. But where is it all seen? It's seen inside your mind. It's really, in the end, everything is experience. That is the most basic currency or unit of existence, is experience. And that is all relates back to your mind and how your mind works. I don't know if that actually answered your question, but anyway, that's my answer here. So, yeah? Circumstance and karma?
Yeah.
What do you mean by circumstance?
Let's say opportunities, threats, good times, bad times. Okay. What's the correlation to karma? You know?
Okay, so there isn't any correlation. The only correlation is how you deal with the circumstances, right? So that's where it is. It's how you deal with it. That's the correlation. So if you are in very difficult circumstances, but you deal with it in a skillful way, you create good karma. If you are in a very difficult circumstances, but you succumb to the difficulty and you deal with it in a bad way, you create bad karma. So the circumstances are just a potential. They are nothing in themselves.
So it's basically the meaning that we give.
Yes, it's the meaning that we give. And this is another... Ajahn Brahm wrote a book a while ago called Opening Door of Your Heart, which has all these nice little stories in it. And be careful, because one of the things about these books by Ajahn Brahm, they seem so innocuous. It tells all these stories and these jokes, right, in this book. And sometimes people think, oh, there's no real profound Dhamma here. It's wrong. It's very profound. And you just have to read it in the right way to understand that actually it is very profound. And one of the stories in there is about the two ladies, right? They're both baking a cake. Maybe this is being a bit sexist, but it's not ladies or men, whoever. Somebody's baking a cake, right? And one of the people who's making a cake has the best kitchen in the world, right? With the best appliances and incredibly good ingredients. And everything is just right, right? Everything is just perfect. And the other person, they have this really old kitchen from the 1950s or whatever. They don't really have any appliances. Everything has to be done by hand. Have really dodgy ingredients, right, with the butter going rancid and the kind of the raisins being hard and all these kind of things. Who makes the best cake? Right? Who makes the best cake? You don't know. It's quite possible that the person who had all the bad ingredients and had the bad kitchen makes the best cake because they put more love into it, more care into it, more of themselves into it. Well, the other one maybe doesn't care so much, and for that reason, the result isn't that great. And this is about karma. Karma is about how you deal with the circumstances of life. Even if you have very bad circumstances, if you deal with it in the right way, you can make a beautiful life out of it. And that's why often you see one of the things that I always found so fascinating. Sometimes you go to these incredibly poor places, you know, to some of the poorest places in the world, like, you know, when I go to India, you see a lot of poverty in the north of India. Bihar is the poorest state in India. If you want to see poverty, my goodness, that is a good place to start. But sometimes these people who have this incredibly poor, they have this beautiful smile on their face. And there is a real sense of happiness there, right? And sometimes if they play their cards right and do their thing, they have an incredibly bad start in life. Chances that they will that life is not going to be good for them is very high. But if they play the cards right, and sometimes they do, they can overcome those difficulties and actually rise above that, at least in a spiritual sense, if not in a material sense. So that, I think, is really what it is about. Okay. So, more question? Yeah. Yes, sir. 18 hours a day. Okay.
Not because of choice, because of the amount of people that come to see. Now, the issue is, because of this job that I have no social life.
Yeah.
Anywhere I go, I get a call, I go back to work. Anywhere I go, even in the country, about 2-3 months back, I went to Rinko, landed there, got a call, came back rushing.
Yeah.
You don't know how to say no.
Okay, yeah.
But you know that if you are there, you're saving a life.
Yeah.
So how do you manage that?
Yeah, okay. Well, you imagine that you're going to die tomorrow, right? Imagine you're going to die tomorrow. How would you act today if you knew you're going to die tomorrow? What would your choice be? Would your choice be to spend a bit more time with your family? Or would your choice be to go and save the patient? Right? That is what you have to ask yourself. You have to find the balance in life. You can't save the whole world anyway, right? Even if you work 24 hours a day, you still wouldn't be able to save anybody. There's always limits. And sometimes you have to accept that there are limits. And once you accept that, you can... Remember your family. This is a choice that you have made, right? You made a choice to marry somebody. You have kids, presumably. You have children. You have a wife. They need you, right? You're their father. You should be around for them a little bit. So remember, it's so important to find that balance. So if you're going to die tomorrow, what is the right balance today? That is how. This is one way of finding that solution. Because in ordinary life, things can get too hard to actually too hard to resolve. And I think that when you look, the thing is that what you are doing is either way is a wonderful thing, right? I mean, you being a neurosurgeon, you're helping people, it's wonderful. Being with family is also wonderful. But just remember that you have responsibilities in both places, and that is why it is so important that you find a balance for that. And if you can find that kind of balance in your life, I think it will be more enriching, right? If you eventually one day comes and your kids say, "Dad, you weren't really a good dad. You were never there. You were always looking after everybody else, but not after us, right? You chose to have us, not looking after us." Then you won't feel very happy with that, right? You feel a little bit guilty, and you feel a little bit bad. So make sure you don't get yourself into a situation where maybe later on you will regret your choices. Remember that responsibility here. And then you can say, listen to your family as well, to what they have to say here. Because probably they're coming from a heartfelt place, right? They really want to see you more here. So it's not easy. I mean, especially in your case, because you're doing so much good either way, right? So it's very, very hard to make a clear choice. So really it's up to yourself. You have to answer. Tonight, when you go back home or wherever you're going, sit quietly for a while and allow the answer to arise by itself, right? Is what I've been saying. And then hopefully you will find the right answer that way here. Yes, sir. Please, sir. Yeah.
A larger percentage.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure.
And this tends to create jealousy. They obviously don't realize that they are not effective, but the others are doing the work, but still they feel there should be equality and they should have their due place and so on.
Who is jealous? The people who do less?
The employees. those who are not very effective.
Yeah, they get jealous of the others.
Very jealous of others who are doing well.
Yeah.
Not realizing their own, lack of whatever.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with such people who don't realize that their input is not that great?
Okay.
That jealousy is very apparent in a lot of organizations.
Sure. It is very difficult because people are deluded by nature. People cannot see things clearly, and this is just the nature of human beings. So it's actually very hard to pull people out of that delusion and to show them what is going on. So maybe what you have to do is to have some kind of neutral way of assessing people, some kind of neutral benchmark, and that benchmark then becomes the way of assessing people, so they can see for themselves that actually the other person is actually more efficient, they're actually dealing with this in a better way. Because that neutrality means that, it's not personal anymore. They won't come back to you and say, "Oh, you're treating me badly." There actually is a neutral benchmark which actually decides who has actually performed better, if you like. That might be one way of doing that. I don't know if having all these benchmarks is a good thing or a bad thing in a company. I don't really know that. That takes away the personality, the personal conflict in that kind of situation. Sometimes there's not much you can do. Sometimes there just isn't. Sometimes people will get jealous. And sometimes you're just going to have to shrug your shoulders and say, "Okay, this is life. People get jealous." And that's what happens. And then if they leave the company as a consequence of that, it's not such a big loss anyway if they did only a small job. So, you haven't really lost very much anyway. So you have to do the right thing, right? If you are a manager, you cannot allow people to rise up just because they feel jealous. That would also be the wrong thing. It is their problem that they are jealous. It is their defilement. And it's something that eventually they will have to understand for themselves. But the very fact that you understand the problem, you understand the situation, means that you can have a degree of compassion for them, right? And it means that you can talk to them in a nicer way because you understand their feelings. It's not nice to be jealous. It's not nice to feel that somebody's overlooking you. And then you have a sense of compassion instead. And then your communication with them will also be much better. And then you might be able to make them understand what is going on and why things are happening in this particular way. But I'm very happy I'm not a manager, right? it's a really good thing. I'm a monk. I can go back to my little hut in the forest and just kind of chill out, you know, and have a good time. I'm very, very happy about that sometimes. It's very, I think it's very hard. And sometimes the decisions you have to make are obviously very, very, very difficult. I don't envy you these kind of things. Okay, at the back again. Yeah. So you're asking whether how important it is to understand the suttas from the Pali or the Sanskrit, and or is English good enough? Sure. the answer to that is I would not recommend ordinary people to, you know, I'm a monk, I'm a professional, I do this full time, right? So for a monk or a nun, I think it is useful to learn the Pali because this is your life. But I think for ordinary lay people, I think it's just too much, takes too much time, right? Unless you're some kind of language genius, and all you have to do is open the books and you kind of understand it very quickly. In that case, maybe, but most people aren't language geniuses. It takes a lot of effort to learn Pali. And so for that reason, I would say, no, don't do that. If you can even read the suttas at all, you're already doing far more than the vast majority of people. Majority of people don't read the suttas. I have never stayed in Thailand myself, but many of my fellow monastics have stayed in Thailand as monastics. And they say that, you know, sometimes you can ask another monk. You mention in passing the Digha Nikaya. Digha Nikaya is the long discourse of the Buddha, right? And they look at you with a blank look in their eyes. They've never heard of the Digha Nikaya before. They don't even know what it is. This is a very basic teaching of Buddhism. Right? So this is the kind of problem we are up against. People don't even know what the basic teachings of Buddhism are. And this is what we see around the world, Buddhist or not Buddhist. So if you can even read the suttas, you are already ahead of 99% of Buddhists in the world, if you even open the suttas in the first place. Maybe not 99, but 95% of Buddhists in the world, you're already ahead of those, even by just opening the suttas as such. So don't be too kind of... put the bar too high. If we put the bar too high, we'll never get anywhere. Start reading the English and enjoy that. If you don't understand, then come to somebody who understands and ask questions about it.
If I can follow up on that, how do you instill the Dharma in the current generation? Because when we were growing up, we grew up in an environment where we were taken to temple. We were compelled to learn some of the gathas, but our kids don't have that environment anymore. But is that important, or is it the more spiritual teaching that is the greater importance?
I think I don't know if it matters that much whether you get taken to the temple as a child. You know, you hear all this kind of this verses in Pali, nobody understands what's going on, you light a bit of incense and the monk said something you don't understand, you know, and then you go back home. I mean, it's okay, you become a Buddhist in name only, right? And you don't really become a Buddhist of your heart. I think one of the powerful things is if you don't go to the temple every week in this way, that you actually make a real choice in life. What do I want? How do I want to live? And that if you make a real choice about things, it is much more powerful. It is just like me. I became a Buddhist from nothing. And I think that is one of the reasons why I'm very committed to the Buddhist thing, precisely for that reason, because I actually chose it myself. So I think there's a lot of good things that coming out of that. It's not, you know, what's the point in having vast number of Buddhists who don't do anything with the Buddhist teachings? It's pointless. The whole purpose of the Buddhist teaching is to practice it. It has no value if you don't practice it. This is a very different, the great difference between Buddhism and other religions. In most other religions, it's about faith and belief is the essence of the teaching. In Buddhism, the essence of the teaching is the practice, how you live your life. And if you just have faith or just belief, or you're just a nominal Buddhist, you kind of tick the Buddhist box on the census form or whatever, that doesn't really make any difference. It has you get a bit more political clout, right? If you have large numbers, kind of the politicians take you more seriously. Which obviously is useful, right? Because it means that they kind of listen to what you have to say. It's very nice. But we shouldn't run after those kind of goals. The most important thing is actually the practice of the teachings. So what we should do, we should make the teachings available to the younger generations. We should make them available in such a way it makes sense to them. It answers some of the questions of life, right? And then, when they understand it, then they can either reject it or accept it, depending on the temperament. If they then reject it, fine, at least they know what they have rejected. Most of the time, you don't even know what you're rejecting. You're rejecting a Buddhism, you never understood Buddhism in the first place. Then you become a Christian, but you actually weren't ever a Buddhist in the first place. At least you have a real choice when you understand what the teachings is about. And this, I think, is one of the most crucial aspects for Buddhism in today's world, is basically to make the teachings accessible and understandable in a way that people can understand what is going on. Then they can make real choices. Then we get real Buddhists, and then we actually helping to improve society and also improving ourselves. Okay. So, yeah.
Hi, I have a small question about obligations. So as we are all working and we have a lot of official commitments as well as family commitments, and sometimes you do not have time, say, for yourself, and there may be your family.
Yeah.
And how do you handle that? Because sometimes when you have to say no, people on the other side feel it's they make you feel bad, or... Yeah. Or you feel bad because you cannot go, and how do you kind of handle that to make you feel that it's not so bad if you do not, or you cannot go?
Yeah. Well, you know, all of these things kind of, you know, come together. All of these things are kind of part and parcel of the same thing here. If your general attitude towards people is kindness in ordinary life, and you're kind to people, whether it's your family, your business, or whoever else it is, if you're generally living a good, right life as a Buddhist, people would normally have more time, find it more easy to forgive you for your not being able to do everything in this world. And this is actually the most important thing. If we kind of start off in the right way, we start off with the right foundation, people will tend to be much more understanding of you as a consequence. So this is what I think actually is the most important thing. So if you generally treat your wife, you're married, yeah? Your wife, your kids, your parents, you know, all the social obligations that you have, if you generally treat them well and they feel that you're coming from a good place, doing the right thing, yeah, they will also more easily forgive you when they understand that you have other obligations that you have to look after, right? So you have to basically show that you care, right? Show that they are important to you, that they are important parts of your life. And the same thing in the company life. Show that you care there as well. And this feeling is very powerful. When you feel that you are cared for, wherever that is, people will tend to be so much more caring in return, so much more forgiving in return as a consequence. And then it's much easier to deal with her. But of course, it is not perfect. It's never going to be 100%. There's always going to be times when you will feel a little bit guilty, perhaps, right? And you just have to recognize that you cannot do everything. There are limitations on you. There's no reason for you to feel guilty not to allow other people to control your emotions. One way of doing that is, again, do a bit of meditation practice. Calm down a little bit. Get clarity about things. When you have clarity about things, you can make decisions that are more, I know this is right. And you don't feel so bad about it afterwards, right? Don't make decisions when you feel emotionally upset or emotionally attached or whatever it is. When you make decisions then, it is often has a component which makes it more easy to regret the thing afterwards. So these are very, very basic things, but it's not going to be perfect, right? Let's face it straight away. All you can do is kind of reduce the problem a little bit and then take it from there. Okay. So it would be nice if there was kind of the final answer, right? This is the final answer. If you do this thing this way, then everything will kind of resolve itself. But in the end, there is no final answer to many of these questions. All we have to do is manage it to the best of our ability. So that is how it goes there. Is there anything else I should cover which I haven't covered, which we need to talk about? One more question. Okay, good. So we'll do one more question then.
Reverend Sir, having listened to you about compassion and clarity in all of what you've said about slowing down, if you take one of the most successful companies in the world, it was run by Stephen P. Jobs, who's no longer among us.
Yes.
Yeah. But if you read his biography, you talk about what a bad boss he was, what a bad husband he was, what a bad father he was.
Yeah.
But he's run the most successful company probably to date.
Yeah.
How do you explain that karmically? I mean, you know, compassion and all of that is not in his vocabulary, but he continues to produce the most amazing numbers quarter after quarter.
Yeah. Yes. That is interesting, right? And it shows you that there are so many factors coming together. Compassion often isn't enough. Compassion sometimes doesn't even work. There are so many things coming together that create success. And Stephen Jobs was supposed to be a Buddhist as well, right? He was a bad example, right? Don't do what he did. He went the wrong way. So this is where what I was talking about before becomes so important. Remember the idea that this life is only a tiny sliver. It is about the much bigger picture that really matters. Now, I think what happened with Steve Jobs, he was probably completely obsessed about this life. He was an incredible perfectionist, right? He was famous for being just shouting at people, saying, this is not good enough, you have to get it better. And that is basically how he succeeded in business. Incredible perfectionism, incredible focus on this life, forgetting the bigger picture. And I think, you know, obviously, if you are a person who have a lot of anger, a lot of problems, I think he also had a lot of wisdom. There's so many sides to Steve Jobs, right? So many kind of different sides to him. So if you... It has done a lot of good in a certain way, right? To become wealthy or whatever, possibly. But in another way, he hasn't done good, because he has obviously created a character which is a bit angry and irritated and difficult to deal with. So he has done a mixture of good and bad. And the goodness came out in his wealth, the badness came out in his character. What do you think is most important, to be incredibly wealthy or to feel happy about yourself? I have no doubt what I would choose. I want to feel good about myself. I want to feel happy. I see so many miserable rich people in the world. What's the point of being rich and miserable? It's much better to be kind of an ordinary person and actually feel happy in your heart. I find the more inspiring examples in the corporate world. I know that many people kind of idolize Steve Jobs, but I think you're right. He actually wasn't a very good example at all. But some of the people that I find very inspiring are people like, you know, at least to some extent, I don't know the details, but people like Bill Gates, for example, or Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett is kind of the richest investor in America, you know, the second richest man in the world or whatever. And the way they deal with their money, I find incredibly inspiring. Here they are. They have more wealth than almost anyone, you know, like they're more wealth individually than some countries have, right? They're more wealthy than some of these very poor countries in the world. And the way they spend that wealth, starting up foundations to give it all back to society again. Wow, it is so inspiring. They have spent their whole life building up this fortune. That's the first half of the life. The second half of life is to give it all away. Right? And that's when you understand why they got wealthy in the first place. They got wealthy in the first place because the seed of generosity and kindness is very deeply embedded in them. And that's why they continue that act of generosity and kindness in this life. I find that very inspiring, much more inspiring than the Steve Jobs. Yeah, Steve Jobs, he made some kind of nifty little things like the iPad and the, you know, this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, big deal. Isn't it much better and much more important to build a beautiful mind and a beautiful heart? Isn't that what really matters in this world? So remember the big picture. And that is where I think Steve Jobs went wrong. And when you remember that, then you will take a different tack in these particular matters. Is that what you are asking, or am I getting the question completely wrong here? Yes? Yeah, okay. Thank you. Okay, very good.
Thank you, Dante.
In most sutras, at the end, you find this statement which says, it was beautiful. It was like uncovering something that was covered. It was like lighting a lamp when there was darkness. It was like showing a path to a person who didn't know how to go. In the last 2 hours, you tried to do that. And I think all of us benefited. And you brought out beautifully that there are no digital yes or no answers to life. And that is one of the most profound things in Buddhism. It's not this or that, so that's more than that. I think you got us to think that. Much merit to you, Bhante. And may your path be straight and strong, and may you be well and happy.
Okay, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Very good, sir. Okay, so very good, yeah. Thank you.